or this NPR station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. We're going to talk about a legendary reporter for the New York Times. He covered the civil rights movement, and his name is John Herbers. John often reported major news, anti-war protests, civil rights marches, the 1968 presidential campaign, and the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. He covered the Watergate scandal and the resignation of Richard Nixon. But perhaps he was best known for his coverage of the civil rights movement. He covered the alleged killers of Emmett Till, their trial, the Birmingham church bombing in which four girls were brutally killed, the murders of the civil rights workers, James Chaney, Mickey Schwerner, and Andrew Goodman. He died last year at the age of 93, but before he died, he finished a manuscript about his years covering the civil rights movement. He finished that manuscript along with his daughter, Ann Ferris Rosen. Ann Rosen will be speaking this afternoon in Tampa at Inkwood Books, and she joins us right now. Ann, welcome to WMNF. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thanks for coming by. Your dad was really at the heart of some of the major events of the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s.
He truly was. I call him the Forrest Gump of journalism. It seems he was at so many major American events in contemporary history. As you said, he covered a lot of national events. He was with Bobby Kennedy when he was shot. And he covered the civil rights movement for UPI, the affiliate, and the New York Times for more than a decade. And he was at so many of the major benchmarks of the civil rights movement. 3 months after joining the New York Times, he was in Dallas for the assassination of John Kennedy. Wow. He was in Birmingham, Philadelphia, Mississippi. He covered the murder trials of Medgar Evers. You know, the list just seems to go on and on. Fortunately, he tended to take his family with him on some of these assignments. And so I had my own firsthand exposure.
Mm-hmm. He was a white Southerner. He grew up, he was from Tennessee, went to Emory University. He was a World War II vet. How did his World War II experience affect him?
It had quite an impression on him. Deep South Dispatch, the name of the memoir, really documents all these landmark events, but it's also this deeper personal story of his journey as he rejects the accepted mores and the laws of a segregated society while still holding tight to his heritage. But it was an evolutionary process, and it began with his leaving these small southern towns for the first time to ever go anywhere other than what his hometowns to serve in World War II. He was 18 years old, went to the Philippines. He said, of course, there was no good to ever come from war, but for him, it had two advantages. He discovered the joy of reading, and it opened his eyes to a larger world. But he also met people from a larger world. So when he came back to Mississippi to work as a young reporter, he really examined that world with new open eyes.
So this is in the late 1940s. Just describe the world for us of race relations back in the late 40s and what your father experienced growing up in Tennessee.
Right. He grew up in a society where the family, the church, business, everyone in society taught him that the races were to be segregated and that the black race was there to serve whites. He did not question this. Very few people questioned it at the time. It was the status quo. It was just the accepted way of how things were. His family were not ardent racists who would go take violent measures, but they went along with the rest of society in a very genteel way of having a white higher level class of people than blacks.
When he was serving in Asia, was he aware of racism by American soldiers in Asia?
No, he really wasn't. He learned from the war, going back a moment too, that something was wrong when he was in combat situations and killed a Japanese soldier. And he really grappled with his conscience that was not what he should be doing, even though he was trained as a soldier to do that. And so he had a real, crisis of conscience and he also questioned authority. So when he came back, he began questioning the authority of the lessons he had been taught. But it was a long evolutionary process. It began in 49. In 1951, it was one of the first racial stories he covered. It was the execution of a man named Willie McGee. It's not very well known these days, but it was at the time it was internationally acclaimed. A black truck driver had been convicted and found guilty of raping a white woman in Mississippi. And he was there for the execution. At the time, Mississippi had a traveling electric chair. It was pretty brutal.
Yeah.
And they would show up at the courthouse and string a cord from a generator in a truck outside the courthouse to the electric chair. He was outside with the crowds as they cheered and roared when the generator geared up and the execution began.
How did he feel about that?
Well, do you mind if I read?
I don't mind at all.
There's a great portion in the book. I'll let his words speak for themselves. He says, by 10 p.m., more than 500 people had gathered outside the courthouse. Most were men, some sitting in lawn chairs, who mumbled and laughed as they waited. The weather was pleasant and the scene festive. Boys and young men climbed to the top limbs of tall trees around the courthouse for a better view through the open window. I pushed my way to the front of the crowd. Let's everybody be nice, a highway patrolman standing on the concrete courthouse steps said to calm the crowd. When he announced that McGee was going to die, everyone shouted a cheerful glee. We want no demonstrations, the patrolman said. You've been patient a long time. Those of us outside knew the execution had begun when the generator loudly kicked into gear. A cheer went up around me. I felt sick as blood washed from my face. I looked around me and thought about how barbaric the scene was. There seemed to be an inordinate amount of cruelty in those times, perhaps because people had just come out of the brutality of World War II. But But whatever the reason, the meanness was so immediate that it resonated deeply with me.
Mm. Were there questions about Mr. McGee's guilt?
There were. It was an interesting story because people in the small town in Mississippi said they knew that this had been a consensual relationship. As soon as the affair, she was a married woman, the affair became known, the woman pointed the finger and called rape. And so he was charged and convicted with that. Bella Abzug, who went on to be the New York Congresswoman, was his young attorney for the NAACP at the time. And it got a lot of international attention. There were riots and protests in London and New York and Washington to protest the conviction, as there were in Jackson, Mississippi at the time of the execution that was held in a nearby town.
So he was writing at this point for the United Press International?
Well, actually, he was writing for the Jackson Daily News. Oh, he was a Cub reporter. He was only...
Was that the Hodding Carter newspaper?
No, it was not. But Hodding had a smaller newspaper in a nearby town in Mississippi. He was only 27 years old when he witnessed this. And it was just one in a litany of incidences that he witnessed firsthand that began this evolutionary process to change his mind.
Would it be fair to say that two things were going on, that soldiers were returning from the war, they had fought for freedom, and if you were an African-American soldier, you kind of looked around at home, especially in the South, and said, what about freedom here? That's going on.
Right. That we call the Double V campaign, with victory at home and victory abroad as well. So.
And then at the same time, there's kind of a white racist resurgence that had been somewhat suppressed during the Roosevelt years. Would that be fair to say, too?
Yes, it was. And the South had come a long way after post-war Reconstruction, immediately after the Civil War, in franchising blacks to vote, and they had great representation. It only lasted about 8 years. And then came in the Jim Crow laws and the black codes, which had to suppress this progress that was being made. So yes, the Jim Crow laws were in full force by the 1940s and 1950s when he returned to Mississippi.
We're talking with our guest today, and we're talking about her dad's book. Ann Ferris Rosen is here. Her dad's book is Deep South Dispatch. John Herbers was her dad. He wrote for a long time for the New York Times, and the book is a memoir of John Herbers' time covering the civil rights movement. Ann helped finish the book. Her dad unfortunately died last year at the age of 93, though he lived a long life.
Yes. Yeah.
You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. He was there at the Emmett Till trial. For folks that don't remember or don't know that part of history, let's talk a little bit about who Emmett Till was and what that trial was all about.
So Emmett Till was a 14-year-old teenager from Chicago, Illinois, visiting his cousins in Money, Mississippi. And Money, Mississippi, that's a misnomer. It was just this small little dried up town. And
there was no money.
There was no money in Money. It was an agricultural community, you know, still using many of the descendants of slaves to harvest the cotton at that time. There are some variations in the story, but he and his cousins went to the general store, and he was accused of whistling at the white store owner. Her name is Carolyn Bryant. And he left. That night, he was sleeping at his uncle's home. In the middle of the night, two men came to the door, demanded to see that boy, and the uncle took them in to his bedroom. They roused him from sleep, put him in the back of a pickup truck, Emmett Till, and took him to a nearby barn where they brutally murdered him. Then they tied a cotton gin fan around his neck and dumped him into the Tallahatchie River. It was known all over town who committed the murders. The guys were bragging about it, lest his wife be somehow maligned by the fact that a black boy whistled at her. And so my father was in the community, as they were looking for the body. He was there when they dredged the body up from the Tallahatchie River. It was completely misfigured. They had been beaten so severely. The only identification was a ring he was wearing his father had given him. His mother, Mamie Till, demanded that the body be sent back to Chicago. It was. And she also demanded on having an open coffin so that, she said, the world could see what they did to my boy. It was a great example of how the media was so important in exposing this story, because tens of thousands of people lined up to witness the body, and two black publications, Jet Magazine and another black publication, published the brutal photographs of this disfigured face. And it first was only known in the black community, but then it became nationally known, and people were witness to what had happened, and really started, some people say it's one of the first beginnings of the civil rights movement. This was 1955. So my father, again, was just a cub reporter. This time he was writing for UPI. And so his dispatches went all over the world. Japan was particularly interested in the story, and his stories also went to Paris. He was in the courtroom. But right before he died, he was one of the few reporters still alive who was there at the time. And he, in Deep South Dispatch, he just gives a riveting, very detailed account of what he saw and the proceedings of the trial. Even though these men had bragged about the murder, they were acquitted by an all-white jury, and everyone sort of expected that to happen. But again, I just want to sort of just read a passage of when he was there for the verdict. After sitting in that courtroom for 5 days and hearing evidence beyond a doubt that the defendants were guilty, the verdict still shocked me. Tired and angry, I drank a beer and got in my car to drive home to Jackson. How would I explain to Betty and my two young daughters that something like this had happened in America, much less in a state we called home? A few miles outside Sumner, I felt a nagging tug in the pit of my stomach. I was mentally and physically exhausted, and I was also beginning to see that my long indifference to Southern suppression of blacks was as displaced as the motives of those who enforced the suppression. I hunched over the steering wheel and cried. I couldn't stop crying for many miles. I wanted to cry Mississippi out of my very core.
That's a really powerful line, cry Mississippi out of my very core.
It was very powerful, and yet another instance where he was grappling with, this was his state, this was his family, this was his heritage, but he wants to cry it out of his core at the same time.
Did this make him begin to write sarcastic articles about the South, or portray, I mean, did he always consider himself an objective reporter?
He did. He held himself to very high standards. There was never any sarcasm and very little subjectivity in his writing. It was really sort of just the facts presentation to let readers make up their own mind. And he writes about it in the book, and it's very relevant to journalistic coverage today. And he had impulses to not only write in much more strong language, but also many times when he's watching civil rights protesters being brutally beaten, to intervene and beat up the bully. But he writes about how his credibility would be at stake, and that he was much more effective, especially as a journalist for the New York Times, to not be part of the story, to be the eyes and the ears for the public.
At this point in American history, there was a strong black press, like papers like the Chicago Defender and other, and you mentioned Jet, and I think Ebony magazine was coming out at that point. But oftentimes, news about African Americans didn't make it into white publications.
No, when it did, it was some salacious crime or something horrible that happened. The news media was as segregated as the rest of society, and not just in the South. It was like that in many communities across the nation. And so the New York Times did not even give courtesy titles, which was the proper Mr. or Mrs. that they would always give whites. They would not give that to blacks. They were the first to change that in 1947. But it was a very segregated reading public, and even the reporters were segregated. At the Emmett Till trial, they were relegated to a card table over in the corner. That was only after the judge finally convinced the sheriffs that they should even be allowed to sit in the courtroom. So, and my father had a great respect for many of those reporters, and he said they actually could get much better stories because they had sources in the black community that he didn't always have.
So the black reporters are relegated to just a card table at the Emmett Till trial where there are, I imagine, there were dozens of reporters. Lots of people wanted to cover that.
There were. One was Simeon Booker, who recently died. He was there for Jet Magazine. He has a great book writing about how dangerous it was for him to go from Chicago to report on that trial. Mamie Till, the mother, sat at the table with the reporters. And there was a black congressman, Congressman Diggs, who came down for the trial as well. He was also relegated to the card table. They used the card table the first day. The crowds, the number of black reporters and other blacks relevant to the trial became so large they moved them to a little bigger table, but not much. So.
I always have that image of To Kill a Mockingbird in my head when I think of Southern trials, that the black people are forced to stay in the upstairs balcony, not allowed on the main floor of the trial. Did the trial of Emmett Till's murderers, did that resemble To Kill a Mockingbird?
When you read Deep South Dispatching, he describes the courtroom, it sounds exactly like it's come out of the same courtroom. The paddle fans, no air conditioning, so many people crammed into the courtroom that they stripped the blinds off the windows because they were so many people. And the segregation of the blacks from the whites in the courtroom.
Well, we're talking about John Herbers, whose account of covering the civil rights movement has just been published. It's called Deep South Dispatch, Memoir of a Civil Rights Journalist. John's daughter is here, and Ann Ferris Rosen is here. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Ann will be speaking this afternoon at Inkwood Books at 6 o'clock tonight. Is that right?
From 6:30 to 7:30, I believe.
Okay, 6:30 to 7:30.
Come at 6. I'll be there.
Okay. Inkwood Books is right in Tampa Heights in their new location. So, your dad was able to fit in because he grew up in the South. Talk about some of the techniques that he used. I mean, I know that he got quotes from all sides as he covered the civil rights movement. Talk about how he fit in with the white community. What did he do to get them to reveal what's going on?
Yeah, well, he said the New York Times was very smart to hire Southerners. So much of what they called the Yankee press was feeling violence and risks. My father experienced that as well, but particularly if you were a Yankee reporter. But he was a Southerner. He talked Southern. He knew Southerners. He could laugh with Southerners. He dressed like Southerners. And so he was able to be not as obvious. He was a little more obscured in his presence. He says that helped him to avoid a lot of danger. He definitely put his life at risk, and there are instances in the book describing his very close call. But he understood Southerners, and he could relate. Not all of them liked him, but they would tolerate him, Sid.
What was the earliest close call in his reporting?
Well,
or one of the earliest.
Yeah, one of the ones that I witnessed personally is we all went to St. Augustine with him for an assignment. Martin Luther King was there as part of his economic campaign to protest the Jim Crow laws. Extremely violent. They had a vigilante group of white supremacists who had been deputized by the local sheriff, and there were weeks and weeks of violent protests. Martin Luther King's, the home he was staying in, had been shot twice. So my father had been there for about 6 weeks, and we lived in Atlanta, and he finally took a weekend off. He came home. We were all ready to go to the beach. We're standing in the driveway. My three sisters and I were all ready with our floaties and flip-flops on, and he's packing the car, and the New York Times calls. They say, you got to get back to St. Augustine.
This is about 1965?
It's the summer of 1964.
64.
And so he's, you know, my mother's looking at him. She's practically a single mom at this point. And he said, riots or no riots, we're all going to the beach. So he took us all back to St. Augustine, and we would stay in the hotel and swim in the pool, which, you know, was just for whites at that time, while he went out and reported on the assignment. But we were there for about 4 days when in the middle of the night we heard pickup trucks roaring around the outside of the motel. And then they started shooting guns up into the air.
How old were you at the time, could I ask?
I was seven. Hmm. So I vividly remember looking...
It had to be incredibly frightening.
It was. It was. Just not really understanding fully, and I had never seen anything like that before, luckily. He'd taken us to KKK marches and before that, and so I had seen the white robes and the... but those were mainly peaceful, the ones he had taken us to. So this is the first time I had really seen the violence. And it was scary. And, you know, it was scary for my parents. They got the message. They packed us up in the car and took us back to Atlanta the next day. My father returned, but he was again threatened by large crowds of KKK members and white supremacists. And so much so that he retreated to a group of sheriffs who would he was hoping would protect him. They did very little except put him in the patrol car, take him to the edge of town, and said, get out of town. Mm. And so he called the New York Times and said, my life is threatened here. I really think I should not stay. It was the only time he ever abandoned an assignment. And they said, yeah, get back to Atlanta, let things cool off. And I think the only salve was they replaced him by a great war report. He was the greatest war reporter at the time, named Homer Biggert. Mm-hmm. They sent Homer Biggert in, and that I think that exemplifies just how volatile and violent the situation was. It was like a war zone.
What was the attitude towards the New York Times back then? When your dad, by this time in the 1960s, he's writing for the New York Times. Did he go to the Times in 1963?
He did.
Yeah. So, what was the attitude toward racist white Southerners towards a newspaper like the New York Times back then in the 60s?
Well, the whites who were opposed to integration did not like it at all because it really brought the story of what was happening to the world. The black leaders, including Martin Luther King, loved it. And Martin Luther King was a brilliant public relations strategist, and he knew that it was through the power of the pen and the camera and the writers that he would make his story known to the United States. And it was effective. And the New York Times knew it was an important story. They were some of the first to report on the story. Before my father, they had hired Johnny Popham. He was the first reporter to exclusively cover the South.
Your dad was the third Southern reporter hired by the Times, is that right?
Yes, the second being Claude Sitton. Mm-hmm. And they were based in Atlanta, but they were never in Atlanta. They were all over the South covering these violent episodes.
Was Hal Raines working with your dad at that point?
Not at that point, but later. Yeah. And I worked with Hal also.
Because some of the greatest reporters that we remember from the 70s and 80s got their start covering the civil rights movement in the 1960s.
They did. And the New York Times had a history of a Southern connection. The founders had really begun in Chattanooga, Tennessee, with a paper there. And they had some editors in New York when my father was there who were Southern boys who had made their way all the way to New York. So they got it. They understood.
The Birmingham church bombing happened in 1963, right?
Yes.
This is a case where today we would call them terrorists, but back then it was the KKK, who were the terrorists of their day, blew up a church in Birmingham in which four innocent girls on a Sunday morning are blown up. And your dad was there.
He covered that story. He had been there. There had been riots as the black civil rights demonstrators protested in the streets. And the strategy... which again was a brilliant one that Martin Luther King introduced to America for the first time, was nonviolent passivity. So you would go and protest. Legally, you were not supposed to be at these white establishments. They were breaking the law, and the police would charge them. Instead of fighting back, they would reluctantly let themselves be beaten. It made for great television, because what you see are just innocent demonstrators, except for breaking the law, I guess, being ruthlessly beaten. So he had been there for these Birmingham riots. He was, again, trying to get back home to see our family. He was driving to the airport, and he heard there had been this bombing. So he immediately took a U-turn, went back to the 16th Street Baptist Church. And he said it looked like post-war Berlin. One whole corner of the church had been bombed out. There were bodies everywhere. People were bleeding. He describes one young boy coming out and saying, "My sister's in there," and it was like a war scene. And so he vividly describes this in Deep South Dispatch. It's a very visceral description. A lot of these scenes. It's not for the weak-hearted, but it's an important message. But that evening, he went to the homes of the four girls' families and interviewed the parents who had just lost their children that day in the bombing, and was struck by the lack of bitterness and their devotion to the cause. They felt their children had been sacrificed for the cause, and he couldn't help but think about his own four daughters and what it would have felt like to him. So again, there's this incredible emotion, but you go back and read the newspaper stories. I relied on 600 of his articles to help him complete this book. They're very, they're not passionless, because he describes the scenes and his descriptions can't help but evoke some emotion. But he is the observer. He is sort of the distant voice, just trying to let the reader come to his or her own conclusion based on the descriptions.
We're talking about the book, Deep South Dispatch. The author, John Herbers, is the father of Ann Ferris Rosen, who's our guest. Ann is here. John unfortunately passed away last year, but Ann is going to be speaking this afternoon at Inkwood Books in Tampa, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. And our email address is dj@wmnf.org. The next year was also an important year in civil rights history, because that was the year of the Freedom Summer.
It was, and he was there in Mississippi for that.
This was an attempt by people, a pretty diverse group of people from up north, college students, religious people, activists, even in some cases homemakers, Violet Liuzzo, homemaker from Detroit, all went down to the South to sign people up to vote, and sign African Americans up to vote. There was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, there were three civil rights workers, Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney. They had gone into the town, I don't know if it was Philadelphia, Mississippi, but in that area. And they disappeared, and your dad covered that story. Let's talk about that for a moment.
Yes, and it was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and they were part of the Freedom Summer workers. One of the men was a local black resident, but two had come in from New York. One was from a very prominent Manhattan family, and one had only arrived the day before. And they were working in the local communities to help register blacks to vote. There were very restrictive practices that prevented them from voting. They'd have to count the number of jelly beans in a jar. They would have to take a 8-page test on the Constitution, asking questions that you and I probably couldn't even answer. And so they had no representation at the polls, even though the black population was very large. So there was an effort to suppress any sort of voting rights. So again, you're right. A lot of whites from all over the country were now joining the movement, and they would show up by busloads. And my father was there in one small town, Ruleville, Mississippi, when a busload arrived. And the students would all be farmed out to different homes in the community. Black families would support them. And so you did have these three workers who did disappear in the middle of the night. They were arrested, pulled over on some false charge, taken into the jail, and then released. And once they were released, they were never seen again. They later found their charred station wagon not far away. And there was presumption that they had been killed. Martin Luther King came to Philadelphia. My father was there with him to help with the investigation of the finding the bodies, the sheriff's department was not very helpful, and so a lot of the community was trying to support the pursuit of finding these. They finally did. The FBI finally came, and they finally did find the three bodies buried in a small earthen dam. And my father was with the excavation crew as they dredged up the bodies. And then he covered the trial of the men who were accused of the murders.
What happened in the trial?
It went on for a long time, and there was no conviction, as was typical in that time in Mississippi. It was an all-white jury again, because the jury selection was taken from the voter polls. There weren't any blacks registered in the vote, not very many. There were just a few registered. So your juries wouldn't comprise of any black people because they weren't allowed to vote. So it really had not being able to vote had a great impact on the justice system and any voices they might have. And so they were acquitted. Jerry Mitchell, a great reporter, is still at the Jackson newspaper there, later found some evidence that reopened, that allowed the Justice Department to reopen the investigation, and one of the men was later convicted. I think he's still serving time. He's very old.
Mm-hmm. Was your dad embittered by this? I mean, because time after time, these crimes would be committed. Horrible crimes would be committed, and the perpetrators would go off without any justice being served.
I think he learned from those parents in Birmingham to try not to be bitter. I mean, it's hard not to seek, some reparation for all of this. And I think he was also emboldened by the stamina and the conviction of the civil rights workers. And he talks in the book about how they had much greater grievances and suffered so much more. They suffered losing their jobs. They suffered going to jail repeated times. They suffered brutal beatings. And so I think when he saw their trials, it diminished his own feelings mm-hmm. of injustice.
Well, we're talking with Ann Ferris Rosen about her dad's book. She helped co-write it just before he passed. The book is Deep South Dispatch, and John Herbers was her dad, a longtime reporter for the New York Times and the UPI. And this is WMNF in Tampa. Ann's going to be speaking this afternoon at Inkwood Books.
At 6:30.
Okay, so we got that done.
Yeah.
So what did your mom think about this? Because your dad is in the forefront of all this. He's seeing, the bodies being pulled from the dam. He's seeing what happened at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham the year before. He's at the Emmett Till trial. There's no justice there. What did your mom think of your dad's work?
She was really an incredible woman. She died 6 weeks before he did. They were an inseparable partnership. She was almost blindly devoted to the cause and to him. And there had to have been some knockout, drag-out fights, but I never heard one in the entire time that he was a newspaper reporter, whether it be the civil rights movement or moving on to these larger national stories. She took everything in stride with a really good attitude, but he could not have done what he did without her. He got all the bylines, but she was home raising four children and making a safe sanctuary zone for him. Going with him on these assignments when, you don't usually take your kid to a KKK march, unless perhaps you are a KKK member, but as a reporter, that's not traditionally done. And she just had an incredible attitude about it.
Did she tell him to stop and ask for another beat to cover other stories, maybe cover business or something a little bit calmer?
No. I mean, I think she also liked, being there on one of the most important story of the country at the time. I mean, I never heard her try to dissuade him from what he did, but again, if she had, he probably would have done it. So I have to assume that she did not complain.
Did your dad sit down and immediately after he retired start to write this book, or did this have to be, did you have to convince him to write the book?
Yeah, no, he didn't. He wrote the book 20 years ago. So he was 73. He had retired, you know, maybe a decade before that. But he was still busy writing all kinds of articles about federalism and, you know, budgets and different things like that. It was half finished 20 years ago, and it was relegated to the bottom of a file cabinet. About 10 years ago, I picked it up, dusted it off, and I'm a journalist, so I said, why don't we finish this? He was not really enthusiastic. He says, oh, I've already written all that stuff. You know, I said, well, let me go, and you and I will sit down together and complete this. So I gleaned 600 of his articles, and I had sometimes difficulty convincing him, again, because of his objectivity, of explaining how it was pertinent to him, and getting sort of the human voice in there. So he had, you know, we talked hours and hours. We spent 10 years on this book. I mean, I had a day job, so I did it as a hobby. But I sat him down at the typewriter, and he could bang out paragraphs at a time explaining things to me. Mm-hmm. And that really helped. And then, as you said, we were able to finish the manuscript shortly before he died last year. He knew it was going to be published, but he didn't see the final product.
Just going back to your family for a moment, your dad sometimes took you on these events. You were in danger in St. Augustine. Were there other times where you and your mom and your sisters were out with your dad and he was covering a story and you felt like you were in danger?
He and I got tear gassed on the lawn of the Capitol during a Vietnam protest. We spent the summer on a 16-city tour of American cities that had been racked by riots. And, you know, we would just drive through the neighborhoods. He was very passe about it. He almost acted like he had some cloak of invincibility that nothing was going to happen to us. He was very cavalier about it, and nothing did. So, and through all the episodes where he encountered danger, the only time he did was when he got hit in the head with a rock at Richard Nixon's inaugural parade where there were riots. And that was the only time he suffered a scar. So, and then during the Richard Nixon administration, we had a terrorist, I guess you'd call him, some man who would terrorize our house every night. He would come and leave all these notes, and he would like knock on the outside windows. And in one instance, we actually did see him, his face, and he was holding a knife. So there were threats. I shouldn't laugh about it. I shouldn't be so glib.
Well, I guess you can laugh because you survived.
Right.
Yeah. We're going to take some phone calls. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address here at the station, dj@wmnf.org. Ann Ferris Rosen is here. She co-wrote the book, Deep South Dispatch, with her dad, John Herbers. And he was a veteran, journalist who had covered, for part of his career, the civil rights movement, but he also covered other big stories, including the RFK assassination, and he covered Watergate. We're going to talk about those in just a moment. And Ann's going to be speaking this afternoon at Inkwood Books in Tampa. Let's go to Les in Brooksville. Les, you've got a question?
Oh, I just wanted to comment. I want to applaud Ann for keeping her composure while recanting all these terrible stories about America's past. I for one, am very upset. Hearing these things is terrible. It's just a terrible period in our history, and I just think she's doing a great job. I want to just thank her.
Well, thank you. And it means a lot. It does. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right. All right, Les, thanks a lot. You know, I think that's the thing that we walk around the city streets in a city like Tampa today. I know you lived in Little Rock for a while. The southern cities were all segregated as recently as the early and mid-1960s, and there were signs where black people could not go and that we were separated. So for people who are in their 50s and 60s and 70s, this isn't ancient history. This is the history that they grew up with.
It's true, and one thing I really like about the book is it's a wonderful historic retrospective, but it is more important its relevance and what it means today. The timing of the book, unfortunately, could not be better. James Baldwin said, "History is not the past, it is our present. We carry our history with us. We are our history." So much of what you read in this book is reproduced today. When you have men like Laquan McDonald or Walter Scott, those are the Emmett Tills of today. The shooting at the church in Charleston and the shooting in Pittsburgh at the synagogue, those are today's Birminghams. It is not that much different. And so we look at these horrific events, 50 years ago. Well, those are our current history. We are in the middle of a history-making moment now. And I think sometimes we forget that we are now sitting in history. I teach news coverage of racial issues at the University of Maryland. And my students, I try to reinforce that message with them. And I say to them, your children and your grandchildren are going to ask you, what were you doing during this period? Because we are really seeing a resurgence of consideration of race and injustice in America that we have not seen since the 1960s. We had a lull for many decades. There were many people who were still concerned with it, but I'm talking about as far as a national consciousness and a conversation. We've not really had anything this large since then.
The press, too. I mean, even back in the 1960s, your dad was, I think it's fair to say, part of the good guy press. He was trying to be objective and cover things from all sides. But there were press that were trying to say the system of segregation in the South is okay.
That's true. And there were a lot of very established media outlets in the South who, right, exactly, they would not point out that there was anything wrong. And my father came up against a lot of that resistance when he was in Mississippi, trying to write about racial issues and about the interests of black people. And the white producers of the radio shows or the television stations or the newspapers did not want any of his articles that he was disseminating through United Press International. United Press International was very supportive of his work, but he was ostracized in the community. He, was not part of the status quo there.
That was one of the major wire services back then.
It's like Associated Press would be today. And Associated Press was back then, too. But UPI, since it's still in existence, but it's a shadow of itself.
Yeah, because UPI was so big. At one point, they had a radio reporter full-time here in the city of Tampa.
It was really
incredible.
And it was international. It was, yeah.
Well, would you compare that to the radio stations and TV stations and networks that kind of cover up for maybe the president these days make any comparison?
Oh, the media landscape today is just so vastly different. In some ways good, in other ways not. You don't have to be a reporter for the New York Times anymore to document and disseminate injustices in this country. Just a person with a cell phone can capture, an incident, put it on Facebook in live time. So you have a lot of voices now adding to the discourse. You don't have filters sometimes, so the viewer or the reader has to be very critical in what news they consume, the source of the news. I'm pretty old-fashioned in believing that, and I also am a very strong supporter of freedom of the press. It leaves it up to the viewer to be the one responsible.
You're a journalism professor now at the University of Maryland. Are young people who are taking journalism courses these days, are they savvy on what quality news is and what is not quality news? Or do you have a media literacy portion of your curriculum?
We do have media literacy. They are not always savvy. They're young. These are 18 to 24-year-olds, and they have been reared in a news environment where they can get information endless information 24/7. And they've not always been taught to be critical consumers. I have to say that you'd think, who would want to be a journalist in this day and age? We had a 50% bump in our enrollment this year. We think it may be a Trump bump, that there are people now dedicated to wanting to tell the story in an accurate way and also just cover an amazing period in history. I feel like the education is very important. If they did not have the influence of the internet always giving them something else, it wouldn't be as important, but it's critically important now. It's also a much more democratic method. I mean, we used to have three television stations and newspapers, and that's where we got our news from at a certain time of day. And now we have the ability to garner any information we want any time of day, but you just have to be discriminating in what the information is and know who the source on it is.
We're almost at the end of the show. Was there one story that your dad was most proud of?
Well, he had a one-on-one interview with Martin Luther King in St. Augustine. He said it was the most important article of the civil rights period that he wrote. There were others later. He covered the Nixon resigns. You know, there were lots of other important stories and Watergate. But he said there were a couple of reasons why it was so important. It was 2 days before the passage of the Civil Rights Act, which, of course, changed all of our national laws in this country. It was the not only that timing, but also it was a test of Martin Luther King's nonviolent strategy. And he asked some pretty pointed questions of Martin Luther King about that. And he filed the story, and 2 days later it appeared in the New York Times Magazine. And it really did have an impact, he felt, in not only ushering in the civil rights movement, but also giving voice to the civil rights movement as it was now at its getting to be at its peak, as you pointed out.
Ann Ferris Rosen, thanks a lot for coming by WMNF. The book is Deep South Dispatch that she wrote with her dad, John Herbers. And Ann, you'll be speaking tonight at Inkwood Books about 6 o'clock.
So from 6:30 to 7:30. But I'll be there a little early. So
thanks a lot for coming by. Is there a website for the book?
There is. The best way to go to find it is on social media at DP South Dispatch. But also, you can go to my website, which is AnnFerrisRosen.com, and there's information about the book there, too.
Well, Ann, thanks a lot for stopping by, and it's a fabulous history. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115, and I'll play your comments back Monday morning at 11 o'clock. Daniel Ruth is coming up next. This is WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, and thanks to Patty Perkey for being our phone producer today.
Every day, I say I'm loud. I could feel all the joy that everybody could see. Then they know.
Yes, they know.
Every man in this world
should be free.
Listen, I wish I could give all the love that I have in my heart right now today. I wish that I could help someone sadly somewhere going astray. And most of all, I wish I had the answer and the secret to peace. I give this to every leader of the world. And then I wish I had the secret of love, for I'd share this with every man, every woman, every boy, and every girl. Oh, I wish I could fly like a bird,
like a bird
up in the sky. One morning to find out for myself. Oh, you don't even have to die. Listen, I'd fly if I could.
could fly, you see, up to the sun and then down to the deep blue sea. Then I'd sing, yes, I'd sing about freedom. I want everybody to come sing along with me. Let me hear you just sing it one time. Let me hear you say, I'd sing, yes, I'd sing. Come on now.